A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Independent's Coronavirus Podcast. I'm David Marley, Deputy Editor at The Independent. This podcast is about getting behind the headlines, examining the issues that are affecting our lives as we try to come to terms with these extraordinary times. It also gives us a chance to find out more about the wider impact of the virus and how the rest of the world is coping. Today, I'm joined by The Independent's Moscow correspondent, Oliver Carroll, who has been reporting from Russia for more than 10 years. After the Kremlin initially claimed Russia had not been affected by the pandemic, the situation has now become much more serious. Figures show the country has the second highest level of confirmed cases in the world, behind only America. But many suspect the scale of the crisis is still being drastically underreported. Officials still insist there have been only 2,000 deaths, despite the infection rate. And, as Ollie unfortunately has personal experience of, there are also questions over the quality of testing and treatment. Ollie, welcome to the podcast. Delighted you can join us. We'll talk more about your own experience in a bit. But can I first just check how you're doing now and whether you are fully recovered?
Thanks for having me. After a month of various stages of grim, I'm pretty much recovered. I have to say it's been a difficult task to get rid of this virus, but I'm there. And at least last week, I had confirmation that indeed all my troubles were down to this pesky thing with an antibody test, which eventually was positive. So after many failed attempts at finding out what it was, number of really strange symptoms were kind of there, and I'm, you know, hopefully fingers crossed recovered.
Well, it's great to hear you sounding so much better. Can you give us a bit of an overview to begin with about how the situation is in Russia right now? I believe some of the lockdown measures have started to be lifted, but there's obviously lots of questions around the scale of the virus and how widespread it now is.
Yeah, it's a very strange situation. I mean, I'd almost say it's schizophrenic, and sort of part of this, at least the official the position on it is a picture of make believe. So on the one hand, Putin saying we're ending these non-working days, everyone gets back to work. On the other, you know, Moscow is still talking about extending the lockdown until June. It's a real sort of strange postmodern world of masks, where basically Putin is in an alternative reality, and he's basically saying what he thinks is desirable. And it kind of reminds you of, you know, there was the famous paradoxes of the Soviet Union. Nothing in the shops, but fridges are full. Everyone is unsatisfied, but everyone votes unanimously. So here we have a sort of, it's a national emergency, but let's call it a holiday. It's a holiday, everyone has to work, and besides, the business can pay. The quarantine is over, but you have to stay at home. Everyone is unsatisfied, but they vote unanimously. So it's a really strange situation. It's never really been a proper quarantine, because essentially they've decided they can't afford it. They're not in a position to pay for it. They're saving money for something else. But as you say, the R number is certainly in many parts of the country above one. There are some reports that it's coming below one in Moscow, the epicenter of the crisis. But to say it seems premature to lift some of these regulations, and it does seem that certainly some regional officials aren't very happy with it, is to say nothing at all. So at the moment, this kind of move away from this really strange legal position in which wasn't really clear if it was a state of emergency or not. It seems a bit of a punt to be moving to a new situation, and it doesn't seem to have been conditioned by the facts on the ground, the health, the numbers. You know, we're still growing, we're still not past the peak of the curve. This seems to be more a punt that basically we have to get Russia back to work, and maybe the summer will help, maybe it won't. But yeah, it's a strange situation. On the other hand, I mean, I went outside yesterday. There's this very, again, you know, the officials have approached this strangely. The Muscovites are approaching this strangely. According to regulations, you're only allowed out if you're walking your dog near to your home, if you basically need essential medical care, or you're going to a chemist or a shop. Well, basically, Muscovites have started to play around with those rules, and you're seeing a lot more people out on the streets, many more cars out on the streets. So they're kind of responding to that unclear legal situation in their own way. So, I mean, I'm not particularly confident that this is over for Russia, but we'll see.
And during the kind of earlier period of the last few years, were people a bit more kind of compliant with those rules and regulations? Were the police out in force? Was it feeling quite strict in lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, for a large part of that lockdown, I was either in hospital or at home under strict quarantine. But absolutely, for a large proportion, I mean, Russians have been under, Muscovites at least, have been under strict stay-at-home instructions since the end of March. And for Russians to respond to being told what to do, it's this strange sort of, again, it's another paradox. Russians are living in the least free, you know, one of the least free countries in the world, but they're, in their essence, they're very free. I mean, you tell a Russian what to do, he'll tell you where to go. But actually, they have been more or less very compliant. I mean, of course, when you have policemen on the streets asking you what your business is and so on, that tends to focus minds. But I do sense that's now changing. And if we think that, you know, the kind of messaging that we've seen in Britain from Boris Johnson was vague, well, I mean, Putin is showing a different. It's entirely different league on that front. So yeah, I mean, it's certainly we're just a point of inflection, and we'll see how it goes, of course.
So tell us a bit more about the role that Putin's been playing. Has he been very public, or has he been kind of hiding himself away?
Well, I think very much the latter. We've seen before that Putin hasn't been particularly good in crises. He's kind of disappeared. We saw it with, you know, Beslan. We've seen it in multiple crises. In fact, with the Kursk, I mean, he took an age to sort of go up to meet the families. And he doesn't seem to be very good in these public situations. What he's done is delegate to his regional leaders. He's playing the good cop, whereas the regional leaders are playing the bad cop. I mean, on the one hand, delegation makes entire sense. Russia is 11 time zones. And of course, what makes sense in Moscow doesn't make sense in Chukotka, of course not. But Russian federalism is never really federal. And so much does look up this so-called power vertical. And in terms of the regional response, this lack of, you know, this sort of, you know, disappearance of Putin at the time of, you know, great crisis is causing a lot of problems, because on the one hand, you know, these regional leaders do not want to mess up. So, you know, they are obviously, their health systems are in a much worse state than Moscow. Moscow is fairly well provided for. They have the ability to pay for, you know, treatment regimes and fairly good intensive care provision and so on. In the regions, that's not the case. So you have this kind of pincer. On the one hand, you have really bad healthcare. On the other hand, these you know, mid-level managers, mid-level bureaucrats are absolutely petrified of losing their place in the pecking order. And this is where we have a lot of sort of question marks over the statistics. I mean, if you look at some of the regional press in, say, for example, Dagestan or parts of Siberia, you'll see that actually there are certainly a lot of reports of basically, you know, people being in hospitals three decks up, sort of these sort of makeshift intensive care wards. I mean, sort of horrific stuff. And there's a real dearth of PPE. Many parts of, over 80% of medical staff in the regions are complaining about a lack of PPE. And so all of this together, it's creating an explosive cocktail. I think in Moscow, as I say, I think in Moscow, this is the thing. I mean, we're looking at some of the figures. When I was in hospital, I mean, even the doctors were telling me that the tests were, you know, consistently underreporting. If they were 20% accurate, that was probably a good figure. Some of them were saying it was maybe 10% accurate. So the figures we have of 250,000, you know, times that by 10, you might have an idea of where we are. Against that, we have the reports of, you know, it's about 2,500 deaths at the moment. I mean, clearly that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think in Moscow, there are some moves towards transparency, and the Moscow mayor, against sort of Putin's sort of everything is okay, has sort of come out in this crisis as a really good, you know, as a really impressive crisis manager who's actually started to say, oh, we're not past the curve. Actually, we probably have many more infections than our official statistics. And so, you know, that's one case in Moscow. But again, I have to just emphasize that Moscow, even with these sort of, you know, obviously reduced numbers, which they're reporting, probably is doing quite well. But the problem is we just don't have enough confidence in the figures, even in Moscow. But I mean, in Russia, it's a sort of Pandora's box. We don't know.
It seems to be that the confirmed cases, even if they're being massively underestimated, have grown hugely over the past kind of week or so, where you've had, you know, 10,000 tests served or 10,000 new confirmed cases a day, going up and up and up quite rapidly. But obviously what you're suggesting there is that if those tests are that kind of unreliable, maybe only 10 or 20% accurate, the real numbers could be, there's a kind of huge explosion in cases going on right now.
There are so many variables. On the one hand, Russia is testing people. I mean, to a great, you know, contrast to the United Kingdom. And again, as I say, I mean, I think in there, certainly in Moscow's response, there's actually a success story. But I just can't be too confident about it. I mean, even if it is an underreporting of maybe even 300% of the deaths, I mean, that's still in Moscow. That's 3,000 and 4,000. I mean, compare that to Britain. I mean, it's still a good story. And there are, you know, there are things which hold the UK back. And I think just in terms of the whole structure of medicine, in Russia, you have a sort of system of, you know, doctors, polyclinics, and then hospitals and all these different sort of infectious hospitals around. It's a whole network of them from the Soviet Union. In Britain, of course, all we have is the GP, and then the next step up is the hospital. Well, coronavirus has really exposed that sort of gap. I mean, if you're not basically on death's door, you're not going to be seen. And what I see, I mean, I'm no medical expert myself, but what doctors have been telling me in Russia is that, you know, what part of the problem in Britain is that people are being seen far too late. And I don't get the impression that that's the case in Russia. People are being seen early. They're a little bit more gung-ho on sort of drugs which they're using. They're using, you know, hydroxychloroquine, they're using Keletra, they're using a number of different drugs, and they're basically applying everything, throwing things at anybody and seeing what works. They're using plasma and all that kind of stuff. I mean, ultimately, I think they're probably in a better position than the UK, but there's a number of factors as well which might be contributing to this. It might be that genes play an effect. It might be the actual strain of the virus in Russia is playing an effect. And it might just be some of the interventions they're making aren't so bad. Obviously, we'll be able to see, not now, but in a year when we see the entire excess death figures for the entire year, then we'll have a better idea.
Yeah. I mean, you say the death toll is now roughly 2,500. Even if things are going well, that seems kind of remarkably low compared to other countries. So, is there much scepticism amongst people there? Are they voicing concern about those numbers?
Well, there's huge sensitivity among leaders and representatives of the ruling class about these numbers. We just saw today even Maria Zakharova, who's the spokesman for the foreign ministry, was attacking several Western newspapers for reporting the under reporting of figures. I mean, even Moscow. What my doctors told me was that there was no Russian miracle. Maybe the Russian death count was lower than elsewhere, but there were three things which were probably helping it. First of all, was the fact that young people were getting ill a lot more frequently, and they were the main category of people who were getting ill, and obviously they had better outcomes. The second is that deaths, second is basically that not all coronavirus cases were being picked up, and so if you're not diagnosed with something, you can't die from something. And the third is that if someone was, for example, had a heart attack while they had from the shock of being with coronavirus, that would not be counted as coronavirus. So this has actually been confirmed in the last couple of days by Moscow officials, saying that actually 60% of deaths of people with coronavirus, or diagnosed with coronavirus, weren't being registered. So there you have an idea of the sort of range you might have. But again, you know, we'll only really know, as I say, with the excess deaths. The excess deaths from April are about 20% above what they should be. But there is a sort of theory that coronavirus may have displaced other respiratory illnesses at the same time. So in fact, the figure might be even greater. Mm. So in the year's perspective, we'll be able to see. But certainly there's a lot of skepticism, of course, but especially from the regions. Because people know, you know, quite the situation, the level of healthcare. When people are being asked to treat coronavirus patients without any PPE, not just, you know, having to change it once every 2 or 3 days, but without any PPE, and there's a lot of examples of this. So it's always the case that Moscow has the most. Resources, and they've been able to throw an awful lot at this. I mean, they're sending, you know, Keletra, which is a sort of anti-HIV medicine, home to anybody who's basically treating themselves at home. And this, you know, things like that, which you obviously don't get in the regions.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
I was interested, Ollie, what you were saying about Putin being relatively quiet, especially with Moscow's mayor, you mentioned, being quite vocal and taking a role. How surprised are you about that? You mentioned he's been kind of relatively reticent in other kind of crises, but it seems surprising. His public image, certainly abroad, is of this incredibly kind of strongman leader. You would think from here that he would want to be front and center, kind of taking control of the message.
It wouldn't say it surprised me, because we have had examples of this before, but it's almost that this is an irritation to him. It's come at a really bad time for him. He wanted to have his constitutional vote, which would have, you know, given him the ability to stay in power for life. He had a whole range of you know, sort of projects. So he wanted to sort of go down in history as another great builder of Russia, as, you know, Stalin or Peter the Great, or, you know, these big infrastructure projects, which, you know, he sort of gearing all his ministers up to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's just come up short, he's come so short of answers at the moment. I mean, the economy is in, you know, a really perilous state, certainly for the small and medium-sized businesses. They've essentially been ignored throughout this. Only a few days ago, it was Monday, wasn't it, Putin actually began to talk about subsidies. I mean, we've got none of this, you know, furloughing schemes, no, you know, very limited loans. I mean, they're so limited that they're almost laughable. He's providing a bit of money for kids, but these are really small handouts. And the basic blunt message is, we've got money, but we're going to save it for a different purpose. And that purpose, I think, are these sort of national projects, these big sort of breakthrough projects. Putin today was talking about genetic industries and so on. I mean, he likes to think in terms of, you know, using a crisis to break through. And unfortunately, with unemployment where it is, it's already 1.5 million. And again, we should emphasize that unemployment in Russia is not the same as unemployment in the UK. You don't get housing benefit. You don't get any kind of living wage. It's destitution. And with the way things are going, with, you know, small businesses basically being left to their own devices, that's just going to get worse. So, as I wrote in one of my pieces, the main fear for Russians is less, you know, these sort of medics in white hazmat suits. It's the fear of not being able to, you know, put food on plates. And I think this is why we've got this really strange order to kind of return to work, which isn't driven by any of the real data or health concerns, but it's this fear of disaster and destitution and the decision to prioritize other things which are more important to Putin. But I mean, it hasn't been a good crisis for Putin at all.
Does it hold any kind of longer term risks for him in terms of his public standing and kind of how he goes, what goes on from here?
Well, I think he's going to have a lot less to work with going forward. But then again, I'd also say you'd be a fool to write Putin off. He has built a huge system of checks and balances and trapdoors and all kinds of things if things go pear-shaped. There's very little that can go wrong in terms of messaging, in terms of order, and the way that sort of protests have been basically essentially banned. But I think it's also fair to say that never before has his sort of democratic legitimate hand been weaker, and he's going to have problems with that, because, you know, a lot of, you know, his whole appeal in Russia has been based on this idea of, you know, being beyond democracy because of some kind of claim to legitimacy. I think that's going to be really undermined going forward. But as I say, so few of the outlets of a repressive state have been turned on. I would be very reticent before sort of expecting some kind of revolution or upsurging or so, you know, in whatever form that might be. There's a lot of capacity for suffering and you know, going through awful times in Russia before it comes to that. But as the Russian saying goes, when the uprising comes, it's frightening and remorseless when it comes. And you know, we'll see. But he certainly weakened his grip on power. There's no question about that.
Interesting, fascinating. So tell us a bit more about your own experience with it. You were actually back in the UK, and just before it really kind of got serious, and then you were back over to Moscow and became ill quite soon after, I think.
Yeah, I haven't quite worked out the timing of it all. My antibody tests would suggest that I was infected within the last month, and I've been fairly homebound for most of that last month, so I assume that I was infected either in a sort of in a lift or by sort of a courier delivery or whatever, which actually my doctors were saying is more frequent than people imagined. And so, yeah, I mean, I was feeling very sort of, I felt very weak and got weaker, and then I started coughing up blood. And then I realized I had to go and see medical help. So sort of, you know, put on a face mask and went to the hospital. And at this point, you know, I had no idea what it was. But I could see from the facial expressions of the doctors that, you know, things might be going pear-shaped. But you know how it is when you go ill, you kind of lose a slight sort of, you go into a different world. You lose connection with reality. And then here I was, within sort of an hour, I was faced with this sort of the entrance to the ward, the glass doors, and behind the sort of flashing buttons of medical equipment, and these cosmonauts in white hazmat suits. And that was the moment I realised I was being admitted to a COVID ward.
So that was despite not having a positive test at that point, because as you said, the reliability of the test is not great.
Well, exactly. But at the same time, you know, what do these guys do, knowing that these tests aren't very accurate? I mean, even in the UK, the tests aren't great. It's part of the way you do the viral the nucleic acid tests. You take the sample either from the nose or from the throat, and often the virus is already doing damage elsewhere. So you have a problem with samples. In the Russian case, there also seems to be a problem with the test kits. So, I mean, I kind of understood that. I mean, I had a number of very strange symptoms, not all of which were classic COVID. I mean, I didn't have there wasn't the usual coughing, high temperature, and so on. The problems with me seem to be more connected with bacteria sort of taking advantage of the general weakness. So I had pleurisy and all these kind of nasty things. So, I mean, I kind of understand. I mean, if you don't know that someone isn't COVID negative, you don't really want to be putting them in with other people. So it swings and roundabouts, of course. You do obviously put the person you're putting into a COVID ward at a special risk. But, you know, these aren't perfect times, and you have to do what you can, I suppose.
And you were there you were in for a few nights, right?
Yeah, I was there for 3 days. I mean, I was obviously very keen to get out because of the possibility that I wasn't COVID-ed up. And yeah, they were very very strange, very strange days. I mean, the first night was a little bit delirious, and already by the end, I was getting used to things, managing to speak to these strange Mr. Blobbies I was coming in to see me every day, chatting to them. But I really did want to get home. And coming home was a mighty relief.
Good. Well, we're very glad you are home and sounding so well. Ollie, thanks so much for finding the time to talk to us today. It's absolutely fascinating to hear about what's happening in Russia. And hopefully you'll come back on in a few weeks or a couple of months or whenever in the future and tell us some more about how things have progressed there.
Sure, it's been my pleasure.
And thank you to everyone for listening. If you're a new listener, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen. If you have suggestions for things you'd like us to discuss or correspondents you'd like us to talk to, please do get in touch on email at thecoronaviruspodcast@independent.co.uk, or you can use the hashtag IndieCoronavirusPodcast That's INDY, Indie Coronavirus Podcast, and we'll see your post. Obviously, you can read all about the unfolding pandemic on our website, independent.co.uk, and in our downloadable daily edition app. There's also an email newsletter you can sign up to if you want the latest news and advice delivered daily. Thank you so much again for listening, and please join us again next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.